Hey everybody, this is the Drive On Podcast, where we talk about issues affecting veterans after they get out of the military. I'm your host, Scott DeLuzio, and now let's get on with the show. Thanks for tuning in to the Drive On Podcast. Before we get started, I want to take a quick minute to ask a favor from you. The point of this podcast is to help veterans through sharing stories like the one we're about to hear, but it's not really going to help if no one hears the story. So if you wouldn't mind, hit pause for a second and head on over to driveonpodcast.com/subscribe, where you can find links to subscribe and to review the show on your favorite podcast app. And if you don't mind taking a minute to share the podcast on social media or even directly to a friend who you think might benefit by listening to the podcast, I'd really appreciate it. Okay, so today my guest is Joaquin Watai, and he is a disabled veteran and author of the book PTS Dog, Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder and the Service Dog. He also hosts the Service Dog Show with PTS Dog, which is broadcast on WDVR. He educates, supports, and advocates for other veterans who have chosen to use a service dog as part of their own recovery, which has effectively turned his disability into a mission. So Joaquin, thank you so much for joining me. And why don't you go ahead and tell us a little bit about yourself, a little bit about your military background and kind of things that you're getting into.
It's my pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me. I was in the United States Navy for 15 years, and I had some experiences during my service that I didn't know had affected me. Got home, my final sea tour, 3 years on an aircraft carrier. Got home and went to shores to shore duty, and things were not right. Things were different. My life was falling apart. I didn't understand what was happening. I was drinking excessively, over-exercising, and tearing my body apart to try and deal with what was going on in my head without understanding what was going on with my head. I had an accident which broke one of the vertebrae in my back and crushed several discs, and that effectively ended my Navy career. When I broke my back and was unable to go run for 10 or 15 miles a day, all of a sudden the stuff that was going on in my head caught up, ultimately ending me up inpatient in a mental health hospital in a wing dedicated for service members, where I was diagnosed with PTSD. And I jumped through all the hoops for the Navy at the time and then the VA. I did all the classes. I went to all the different counselings. I took all the pills. And when I say all the pills, I mean I was taking more than 30 different pills, 11 different prescriptions a day. During that time, they did process me for a medical discharge and under honorable conditions. I remember waking up one morning to start my daily routine, which was take my pills, lay in bed, and stare at the ceiling for 8 hours before I took my pills and went to sleep. And that was my life. I literally did, between the pain and recovering from back surgery and all the zombie cocktail of medication that the VA had me on for PTSD, I had no life. I was a zombie. I just existed for my next dose of pills. And I remember laying there staring at the ceiling, thinking there has to be more life than this. And my wife at the time suggested that I get a service dog. And we had just so happened to have recently started breeding Alaskan Malamutes. And so we decided that one of the puppies from our first litter would be my service dog. And at this point in time, I really didn't know what that meant. Didn't understand the laws, didn't understand what was necessary to train him. I was completely clueless. So, you know, I said, sure, why not? You know, I got to do something. Anything's better than this. Skeeter was born, literally fit in the palm of my hand when he was born. And he weighed exactly 1 pound, 16 ounces. he had to be born via C-section, so I wasn't there when he was born because it was at the vets. However, I got to hold him in my hand about 3 hours later, and I knew in that instant that that was my dog. That's not normal. That's how it worked for me. And that was almost 9 years ago. And I never looked back. I started learning about the law. I mean, I knew how to train dogs. I grew up in Alaska. I mushed Alaska Malamutes. When I was in high school, I did sledding, dog sledding. So, I wasn't completely clueless about just training a dog to be a good dog, but I didn't understand things about him being a service dog. Somewhere about maybe 9 or 10 months of age for Skeeter, I decided that the drugs weren't helping me. And I did probably one of the stupidest, most dangerous things I could have done. I quit all the VA drugs cold turkey. And I was very, very sick for quite a few months. That was the dumbest thing I could have done. What I should have done is gone and talked to my doctors and said, this isn't working. I need your help to wean off of these. However, I didn't, and it nearly killed me. But at the same time, as I was so sick and withdrawing from the side effects and of all these drugs, I was working, training Skeeter and reading and learning about service dogs. I started to discover that since he had been born, I had a reason to get up in the morning other than taking drugs. I had to potty my puppy. I had to take care of my puppy. I had to feed the dog, I had to take him and walk him. I had to do some training with him. And so slowly building on his training and my experience with him and my knowledge, I started training him to perform tasks to assist me with my disability. And by the time he was 3 years old, we were working and doing public access and he was really starting to shine. I would say for the past 5 or 6 years solid, he really has not left my side. And I went from a reclusive zombie to published author, radio show host, different veterans groups and productions, radio shows and things reach out to me for my advice, for my opinion, for my, self-taught expertise on the subject. I don't claim to be an expert, but other people call me an expert. What I discovered during the process when I was training Skeeter and learning about service dogs and everything is that there was no one place, there was no one book. I'm the kind of person, if I'm going to do something, well, let me pick up a book and read about it and learn as much as I can about it. Well, that wasn't there. It didn't exist. Well, it just so happens that I was a journalist as my career in the Navy. So I had the know-how. I know I had the training. To do the research, put together a book, interview people, get their experiences in there, and write it. So 3 years ago, I decided that's what I'm going to do. Just a little bit more than 3 years ago, actually. In July of 1996, July of 2016, wow, July of 2016, I started the PTS Dog Project.
Okay, that's. Yeah, that's a great background on who you are and how you got to kind of where you are and everything. I'd love to talk to you more about the process of getting your dog trained to be a service dog. Is it typical that people would do the training on their own, or is it one of those things where a lot of times people will get a service dog that it has already been trained by some sort of trainer, or that's kind of a big black box to me. I'm not sure how that whole process typically works.
There are three ways to get a service dog with little air quotes around it. The Americans with Disabilities Act is the law that protects the right of disabled people to train and use a service dog to assist with their disability. In that law, it specifically states that disabled people have the right, it is a right, it is not a privilege, the law doesn't grant this, it protects the right of a disabled person to train their own service dog. So method number one is to find a dog that has the appropriate temperament and train it. If you have the knowledge, if you have the skill, if you have the patience and the ability, you are well within your rights to train your dog to be a service dog. Specifically, when we're talking about a PTSD service dog, as long as you understand how to train your dog, in my opinion and personal experience, this is the absolute best way to do it. The reason for that is because everything that Skeeter does for me is based on the bond that we formed from birth on up. And that bond, the way you bond with your dog is training your dog. And so as he was growing up, he was seeing my PTSD symptoms exhibit, and he started forming natural responses to those symptoms. And I was able to take his natural response and shape that through training into a nameable task in order to fulfill the requirements of the law, which is that a service dog must be trained to perform work or tasks to assist their disabled handler with their disability. The second method, if you don't have the experience, you remember again, I used to mush dogs when I was a kid. I've been around dogs my whole life, been around Malamutes quite a bit of my life. So I knew what I was doing just in regards to training the dog. The second method is almost as good as doing it yourself. I call it cooperative training. Cooperative training is where you use a trainer or an organization that provides trainers to help you train with your dog. A perfect example of this is TADSAW, Train a Dog, Save a Warrior. They specialize in taking veterans and their personal dogs. They will screen the dog and make sure that it's got a suitable temperament to be a service dog, meaning it's not reactive to other dogs, it's not aggressive, it's not fearful. And then they will go through the veteran and the dog together, will go through training classes with a trainer. And what they're really literally doing is training the veteran to train their own dog. By the time you graduate, the goal is by the time you graduate the TADSAW program, you should be able to turn around and train another team. Learn one, do one, teach one. Remember that concept from the Army.
Right.
And that's a really great idea. That is fantastic. It requires something that I learned by doing it myself. It requires a lot of sweat equity. And that's, I think, the number one lesson from both self-training and from cooperative training is that you get exactly what you put into your dog out of your dog. So if you don't put the time and the effort and the consistency into training your dog, you don't get a dog that's able to perform with consistency, with, you know, and is calm and is confident. Which leads to the third method. Yes, there are organizations out there who provide, in air quotes again, fully trained service dogs. Specifically, there are a lot of organizations that train PTSD service dogs. And here's where I've found through talking with thousands of veterans through the PTS dog, here's where I've found that there's some issues with that. First of all, when I was raising Skeeter and training him, he was exposed to me in full PTSD mode. And he learned what was going on with me, and he picked up on that and started responding when my stress levels started to increase, you know, and adrenaline started dumping into my system. You know, he started to respond to that. Dogs can smell the chemical changes that happen in our bodies. They can hear our heart rate increase. That, you know, but dog senses are much more highly attuned than ours, and they can sense physiological changes that reflect what's going on psychologically in our brains. Right. Well, a stranger can't train any dog to recognize what's going on physiologically when I'm having a psychological meltdown. A third party can't do that. So you have third-party trained dogs exist, and there is a time and a place for them. Look, a mobility assistance dog that does things like pick up your keys and fetch your shoes and, you know, opens the fridge and opens doors for you, that's very specific, very time-consuming, and you have to be very knowledgeable to do that training, okay? That is absolutely a time and a place where having somebody else train the dog and then teach you how to handle dog is absolutely appropriate. PTSD, the whole point in my mind of a PTSD service dog is to be proactive. I have not had a full-on PTSD meltdown. Actually had the first one three or four weeks ago, the first one I had had in about 3 years, because Skeeter intervenes before things get there. And he couldn't do that if some stranger trained him.
Right.
He couldn't.
What are some of the things that the dogs will do for someone who's having a PTSD episode to kind of de-escalate that, if that's even the right term?
Right, right. Yeah. Well, every person is different. Every disability exhibits differently for every person. People with PTSD do have some commonalities. It's common symptomology. We have panic attacks, anxiety, rage fits. Remember that one of the, hypervigilance, essentially the fight or flight response is always right there, ready to go. There's no filter anymore. You're wired tight, ready to rock. And you go one of two ways. You're either ready to fight or you're ready to run. Always. Okay. So that was one of the problems I had, was hypervigilance, extreme hypervigilance. I couldn't go shopping. I would make it 10 or 15 feet into the store, turn around and leave, and go sit in my truck and make my wife do it. I couldn't do it. It was too difficult trying to watch everything going on in an environment I had absolutely no control over. So what I taught my dog to do is watch the environment and warn me when there are things that might be potentially hazardous. At the time, I lived in Colorado, and Pueblo, Colorado, and we had a very bad methamphetamine problem in Pueblo at the time, back in the early 2010s. And Skeeter picked up on the fact that tweakers, I couldn't stand, I was immediately ready to throw down, because you could not predict what these people were going to do, and they're just potentially dangerous because of the drugs they're on. And so I was super, super just, I could, you know, if I saw a tweaker in a grocery aisle, I'd go around. Well, Skeeter picked up on that, and he would start to warn me. So one of the things that he does for me that helps alleviate the hypervigilance is he's my forward observer. He's always walks, he does not work at a picture perfect heel. I didn't train him to, I did train him to, he can walk at a heel, but what I trained him to do is be 2 or 3 feet ahead of me. So he's a 100-pound dog. He's a big dog. So we're still basically joined at the hip, just actual hip to hip. So his nose is out there. He's seeing what's going on in front of me. He looks around the corner of an aisle before I do. And if it's crowded, he'll look back at me and he'll either nudge the cart or me in the opposite direction, or he'll sit, which warns me, hey, it's crowded down there. We might want to go around and come back to that aisle. So then I'm not packed into a crowded aisle, trying to watch my back, right? And it, so I'm not overreacting. So I'm calmer. So that takes that, you know, takes me from that fight or flight response, ready to go, takes it down a notch, takes it down a notch. Another thing he does for me is watch my six, standing in line. People crowd you in line, get, you know, and this is a fairly typical PTSD response. People with PTSD can't handle having that being packed in a line like that. I have a 100-pound Malamute as a service dog. He posts up right behind me at 90 degrees. Nobody approaches my back with a 100-pound dog that looks like a wolf behind me. I can't. Now, listen, remember what I said, the ADA requires that the dog perform a task that to assist with my disability. It also says that I can't perform the task myself. Okay.
Right.
So creating a physical buffer to keep other people away from me in a packed line, right, in the grocery store. There are two ways I can do it. Run, which means I can't shop, mm-hmm. or shove them, which is a felony. It's called assault.
Yeah.
But if there's a 100-pound dog sitting there, no problem solved. Right. So, you know, people say, blocking, that's not a task. Actually, it absolutely is. It fully fulfills the definition as required by the law. I can't do it myself, not without breaking the law. But you know what? Like I said, if there's a 100-pound dog that looks like a wolf standing behind me, nobody approaches me. Mm-hmm. So PTSD service dogs do, Skeeter does nightmare intervention. I start having a nightmare. He comes and gets on the bed and performs another task, deep pressure therapy. He'll lay on me, at least halfway on my body, on my core, and that pressure provides a release of endorphins, a release of dopamine, and it calms. This has been medically proven. That's why weighted blankets work for people. Right. You know, thunder shirts for dogs, same concept. Mm-hmm. I trained him to alert me when I was starting to get mad. When I was starting to get, for lack of a better term, I really hate this word, triggered. I don't do triggered. I talk about stressors, and here's why. What happens when a trigger gets pulled?
Something goes off.
Something downrange gets destroyed. Okay, the result is inevitable.
Right.
So I taught my dog to help me handle stressors so that the trigger didn't get pulled. I try not to get to that point. Mm-hmm. That word has been so abused by politically. It's been co-opted. And that's a shame because it really minimalizes mental health issues. And that bothers me. I hate the word because it's how it's been co-opted. So what I did was I taught Skeeter to warn me when my levels are getting higher, when my stress is starting to come up, I'm starting to dump those stress hormones, adrenaline's starting to creep in there. So level one, right? And he naturally would respond. He picked that up on his own and started coming over to me when I was getting there. And here's, again, back to owner training or cooperative training. Little light went on and, you know, in my head, and I went, oh, hey, but, you know, I did a little self-evaluation. What's going on? Why is he coming over here and nosing me? Oh, I'm starting to get stressed out and mad. So when I realized that's what he was doing, I took that natural alert and I trained it into a task. He sits on my foot. So level one, when I'm starting to get where I don't want to go, Skeeter sits on my foot. That's warning level one. Dad, chill. Got it. You need to calm down. Level two, if I keep escalating, he escalates. He starts leaning against me and trying to push me away from the stressor. Okay. Tries to get me out of that situation. Level three has only happened three times. He turns around, rears up, puts his paws on my shoulders, knocks me flat on my back, and lays on me full length until I'm calm enough to leave. Because what happens when a 100-pound dog is lying on you full length in the middle of a Walmart? You have no choice but to pet the dog because he will not get up. He knows you're about to do something wrong. Mm-hmm. He would not get up. He will not get up until I am calm enough. So I have to pet him because he's laying on me full length. It's natural. It's human nature. If a 100-pound dog is laying on you full length, you pet the dog.
Right.
And again, that has been scientifically proven to produce calming effect. It releases endorphin. It lowers, you know, the stress hormone levels and it calms you. And that's an extreme case. I mean, that's when things are going way too much. And you know, that at that point, when he's laying on me in the middle of a store, without him, I would have been laying somebody else out. Mm-hmm. Fists would have been flying. Or I would have been at a dead run trying to escape.
Sure.
And things don't get that way anymore.
That's interesting, and it's awesome to hear like how the dogs can be be trained and how receptive they are to the chemical changes and all that kind of stuff. My wife, about a little over a year ago now, started having seizures for the first time ever in her life. And we have an English bulldog. So not, and she's, at the time she was like 10 years old. So she was not like, she had never been trained for any, you know, service dog type of thing like that. But when my wife got back home from the hospital, she'd start to have seizures at home, and our dog started to pick up on some of the cues that she would have, and she would come and sit by her side before my wife was even experiencing any of the symptoms, and then. Right. Within a minute or two later, you know, whatever the time period was, she would start to feel like the seizures were coming on. And we started noticing that the dog was kind of instinctively just going to her right before the seizures were going to happen. And it was like every single time, like clockwork, that she had a seizure, the dog was going right to her. And that was with no training, and I'm not trying to claim that she's a service dog or anything like that either. Yeah. But it just goes to speak to the ability of dogs to be able to do that.
Yeah. That's a natural alert. Yeah. That is a natural alert. And absolutely. And again, you know, family dog been around its whole life, bonded to the family, knows something's wrong with mom.
Right.
Okay. And that's a natural alert. And when you find a dog that has that ability that is able to pick up naturally, that's the ideal, because that you take that natural alert and you use it to train that dog to do something specific. So if you want the dog to sit to warn you every time it happens, then you know, you start rewarding. Good job. You warned me as you're taking your rescue meds, if you have that option or whatever, you know. Yeah. And that's, again, though, the only way to figure that out is if the dog's with you.
Sure.
If there's somebody else training the dog, that whole part of the equation doesn't exist. Mm-hmm. And specifically for things like seizures, things like PTSD, anxiety alert, heart rate, diabetes. Diabetes is a little different because you can actually take the sputum of a diabetic and freeze it and send it to a training organization, and the smell of their breath can, the dog can be taught at different sugar levels. You know, when you smell this, do this. That's a little bit different, but it's much easier to do it at home, but with, you know, with the dog right with you.
Sure.
Advice, you know, putting cotton balls in your mouth when your sugar's down to 30 and then, you know, freezing them and mailing. When your sugar's down that low, you're not thinking about that.
No, exactly.
You know, yeah. And that's just, and see, the process of training your service dog, especially a PTSD service dog, forces a couple of things to happen. It forces you to be introspective. You have to think about what's happening, why is it happening, and how do I want my dog to warn me so that I can do something different? Okay. Mm-hmm. And one of the biggest ways, especially in places like public, that a PTSD service dog works is redirection. And I'm not talking about redirecting the dog's attention. I'm talking about where the handler's attention goes. Instead of, oh my God, it's crowded, it's loud. Walmart, perfect example. It's crowded, it's loud. You can't control the environment. You don't know what's around the next corner. You know, all of these things are high anxiety, high energy. Get that fight or flight ready to go. Okay. But if you're focusing on making sure your dog's on point, giving your dog commands, tell your dog where you're going to go. Cause guess what? Dogs can't read our minds. So, you know, tell your dog, hey, we're going right, we're going left. I use sled dog commands, ha and G, slow down. Let's go forward, you know, straight ahead. Handling, an active verb, handling your dog. You start to, you, it becomes what your job is. I don't go to the grocery store to buy groceries. I go to the grocery store to train and handle my dog. Mm-hmm. And that's another thing that both owner training and cooperative training understand and acknowledge, is that training never ends. There is no such thing as a fully trained service dog. It doesn't exist, because a dog is a living being. And if you don't maintain training by training, they lose that training, just like we did in the military. Mm-hmm. If you didn't practice, if you didn't go to the range, if you didn't do exercises. If you didn't practice doing your job in the Navy, it was firefighting. If you didn't do that, you lost the skills.
Right.
Why
right.
do we train all the time? Train, train, train. We're spending so much time training. Well, you need that training when you're deployed.
Right.
But if you don't have the training, you don't know what's happening when you're deployed.
Yeah, what's exactly. All of those skills are perishable. If you don't use it, you lose it. And
exactly. And it's exact same with the dog. So yeah. Here I am. I'm this veteran. I've got the PTSD, and I'm going to get this fully trained service dog. And after 6 months or a year, the dog's not doing what it's supposed to be doing. But they said it was fully trained. What they didn't do was train the veteran. Mm-hmm. They didn't give the veteran the tools that the veteran needed to maintain that level of behavior and performing of tasks, because the whole premise behind a third-party organization training a service dog is that nobody else knows how to train a dog.
Right.
Guess what? Anybody can train a dog. Anybody is capable of it, as long as they want to do a little bit of learning and be consistent and patient and work with the dog. Anybody has the capability if they make up their minds to do it.
Yeah, that's great advice too, because some people might be just shy away from the idea of getting a service dog because they might think it's too expensive to, you know, have a full dedicated trainer to do all of this stuff. And they just would never be able to get it done, for a reasonable cost. And I'm not trying to say that it's inexpensive to train the dog on your own, because there's things that you need to learn and things like that. I'm not trying to say that, but where on the flip side, where you have somebody else who's doing the training for you, that I've heard from other people that can run into the tens of thousands of dollars, and that could be lots and lots of money. And most people don't have that just laying around, you know.
Yeah, there are organizations who claim that it takes. Now, remember, we're talking about nonprofits here. Mm-hmm. So, ideally, there should be no quid pro quo for the vet. Okay, ideally, we provide the organization, we provide the dog to you free of charge. That is the ideal. There are very few organizations where that's actually true.
Right.
Some of the organizations want a dog and pony show, and they have a very specific visual type of veteran that they assist, and they all look pretty much the same, and there's lots of pictures of them, and they show up at events with their dog, and they're put through this media ringer, a dog and pony show. Mm-hmm. Let me tell you something. If you're at the point in your life like I was, where all I did was live to take my pills and stare at the ceiling, there's no way I could have gone out and performed for, you know, such and such organization.
Sure.
The PTSD was running me too much. So think about that. If they expect you to go out and, you know, do and song and dance or, dance a jig, some of these organizations require that the veterans do fundraising. Again, dog and pony show. You have to go out there and raise $25,000 in order to get the dog. That's quid pro quo. That's not the way nonprofit is supposed to work. It dances right on the line of not being legal. Some of these organizations, the ones that I refer veterans to, the cooperative training organizations, require sweat equity. It's the same as training your dog yourself. They require that you come to class, go to class, and when you go home, keep practicing.
Right.
Class a week, then you'd better be practicing. Practice for half an hour with your dog, you know, twice a day, every day until next week's class. Two classes a week, that's a little easier because you have more guidance from the trainer. But a lot of people drop out of these cooperative programs when they realize it's actually work. But guess what? Handling your service dog is actually work.
Right.
Period. No matter who trains it. At the end of the day, when you're walking down the street with the leash in your hand, if you don't know what you're doing, you're in trouble.
Right. Absolutely. Let's talk a little bit about your book that you have. So the book, PTS Dog, Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder and the Service Dog. What's the book all about?
Well, like I said, as I was beginning my, what I now call my PTS dog journey, I didn't understand anything about the laws. I didn't understand what a service dog was, what it could do. I had to discover all of that, for lack of a better term, the hard way. Mm-hmm. And I happen to be one of those, you know, thick-headed knuckleheads who learns best if they do it the hard way. And I learned some hard lessons, and at one point, just being told by some, bottle blonde soccer mom looking woman in a grocery store, you can't bring that dog in here. And going, well, yeah, I can. He's my service dog. Well, he's not wearing a vest. And I realized, wait a minute, there's a problem here. First of all, there are a lot of veterans who are walking around with dogs in harnesses and vests and, you know, all these fancy leashes, and they don't understand what their rights are and they don't understand the law. And at the same time, on the other side of that coin, there are a lot of people out there, businesses, that have no clue what my rights as a disabled person are. And so I started researching. I'm like, there's got to be a book or something that explains all this. There wasn't.
Right.
There was not a book there was not one. I went to the ADA website, did all the research, pulled up all the documentation, read titles 2 and 3 of the ADA, found all the appropriate sections, but that took me a lot of time. That was research that took the training that I got both in college and in the Navy. That took using skills that not a lot of people have. And I thought to myself, look, you know, Johnny veteran on the street who, you know, just spent 9 years in the Marine Corps isn't going to necessarily even understand that these are the kinds of questions he's going to need to ask or answer. Mm-hmm. And that's just it. There's, you know what, 99.9% of the population of the United States doesn't even understand what a service dog is. They really don't. And there's no one place with no agenda where you can find that information, except for the Americans with Disabilities Act website, if you're prepared to sit down for hundreds of hours and read through the U.S. Federal Register and U.S. Code. And let me tell you, my eyes crossed so many times as I was researching and reading through this stuff. So I thought, well, gee, what did I do in the Navy? I was a journalist for 15 years. I was a journalist when I was in college. I was doing radio, writing for the paper. I was a journalist in high school. I wrote for the, you know, for the high school paper. I took photos, you know. Why, what am I doing with my life right now with that training? I've got all this experience and training. What am I doing with it? Nothing. Well, why not? Here's the need. There is no one place to find all this information. Here's my ability. Here's my audience, my brothers and sisters in arms, veterans, who should know this, especially if they're holding onto a leash. So I wrote the book. And what the book PTS Dog is an explanation of the ADA and of PTSD service dog specifically, but it's applicable to any service dog in regards to the law, how they help, and how the law works for service dog handlers and for businesses through the eyes of veterans who use service dogs. So for instance, I tell the story of a restaurant refusing to allow a veteran access, in the veteran's words. And then I explain the law, what's applicable, and how a possible way to redress that, redress that issue and educate the business. One veteran who I interviewed was literally chased off of a bus in Cleveland, Ohio, and harassed face to face, you know, chest thumping and the whole nine yards by the bus driver because of his service dog. This is incredibly illegal, what happened. He took it to court and got a settlement from the city of Cincinnati. That story's in there, and the process he went through to report it and what laws were broken. You know, but I break it down and use the veteran's stories so that it's relatable. And when you read it, you understand that little light goes on. You go, oh yeah, I get it. I understand what that means now. Rather than reading the cold, you know, legal language on the ADA website and trying to slog through the law. Everything I state about the law, I reference where in the law it says it. If you want to look it up, it's in the footnote. Go right there and look up what I, and you know, I don't make any claims about the law that I don't back up with the appropriate reference. So in some ways it's kind of like a term paper, you know, a college term paper, because you can't make a statement about the law and not give the, you know, give people the opportunity to read the law.
Right.
And, you know, all through the PTS Dog Project, I've told people, look, if you don't believe me, here's the link. Go read it yourself. Go to the .gov website.
Yep.
Go to the actual government website where the law is listed. That, you know, read it for yourself. Come to your own conclusions. I'm telling you what I'm reading here, what it says. I'm telling you what discussions with the Department of Justice, ADA division, they have a hotline you can call and ask questions. I've done that multiple times, you know. So I put all of that together. It was stories and photos of the veterans who lived it. And then at the end of the book, I have interviews with, I believe, five different veterans about how their PTSD service dog changed their lives. Or actually, all five of them saved their lives. I do address veteran suicide in the book, my own personal story, and how that big lump sitting on the couch over there next to me saved my life, literally. what else? I talk about access at the VA in the book. That information has changed a little bit since the book was published. The VA came out with some updated policies. All that's available. Anything you see in the book, if it seems like it might be out of date, I've probably updated it already on the PTS Dog page. I've already written an article about it. But obviously, I'm going to have to come out with a second edition with more up-to-date stuff. And, you know,
sure. I talk change all the time.
Yeah. I talk about the fact that the ADA is a civil rights law, and with the understanding that what it does is guarantee equality for disabled people, how using a registry, forcing disabled handlers to register their service dogs would be discriminatory. There's a whole chapter on the service dog registry question. Mm-hmm. And that's an important question, especially right now, because there are people in the service dog community, veterans, who are actively trying to take away the rights of disabled service dog handlers, because there are people out there abusing the protection that we have and claiming that their pets are service dogs when they are not. Why are we going to punish the people who are doing it right for the actions of criminals? Right. And there's a real great parallel there with the Second Amendment. All these laws, all these gun laws, all the law-abiding people follow the gun laws, and they're not breaking any laws. The people who don't follow the laws are the ones going out and shooting each other. Mm-hmm. How does making more laws and incriminating on the rights of lawful people stop criminals from doing what criminals do? The very definition of the word criminal is that they don't follow the law.
Exactly.
You know, it's simple logic, which apparently, you know, is beyond some people in today's society, I guess. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't want to get me on that soapbox, because honestly, look, what we're looking at, and it's a microcosm in the service dog community, what we're looking at is people who want to sacrifice their liberty for a false sense of security. And I can tell you that I have read the comments from multiple Canadian service dog handlers in provinces where they have a service dog registry, and they say it doesn't work. People claim their pets are service dogs all the time. They bully their way in. They threaten to sue, and the dogs completely misbehaved. And here I am following the law, jumping through the government's hoops to register my dog, and it hasn't stopped the problem at all.
Right. And what advice would you have for maybe a business owner who is dealing with something like that, where somebody is just coming in with their dog that's
their
not
pet. Yeah.
Yeah, it's Fee-fee basically a pet. It's not
Fee-fee the wonder poodle. Yeah.
Yeah, Fee-fee exactly.
Look, the ADA, specifically the sections about service dogs, is a perfectly written law because it defines and guarantees protection of the rights of disabled people who handle service dogs, and then it defines the rights of the businesses. And it says specifically, when it is not obvious what tasks a dog is trained to perform, the business may ask two questions. One, is that a service dog trained to assist with a disability? And if the answer is yes, what tasks is that dog trained to perform? Now, any legit service dog handler will start rattling off a list of tasks. Mm-hmm. By the way, PTSD is not a task. Alerts me to changes in my condition that could be dangerous. Good definition of a task. Blocks, creates personal boundaries for me. Helps lead me around. Provides an alert when I'm, you know, about to have an issue with my disability. That's perfectly acceptable. Okay. Now, most of the people who are taking Fifi the Wonder Poodle to the store, when they're asked the first question, will say yes. And when they're asked the second question, have no clue and start blustering. The ADA then goes on to say that if a dog does not fulfill the definition of a service dog, meaning it is not trained to perform work or tasks to assist with the handler with a disability, answers to question number two, it is not under the handler's control, or if it is out of control, the handler is not taking immediate effective action to regain control, which acknowledges that dogs are living beings and they can have bad days too, and it gives the handler a chance to fix it, mm-hmm. or is not housebroken. So if the dog's not trained, not task trained, not under control, or not housebroken, the business may ask that the animal be removed. Period. The only restriction that the ADA puts on the business in regards to asking that animals be removed is that they still have to offer their services to the person. Ma'am, sir, I need you to take that dog out of here because it's creating a problem, and you are welcome to come back in. Perfect example of how business can handle it. Perfect. Service dogs shouldn't be sitting at the table in the restaurant eating food from the owner's plate. It should be on the floor, four on the floor. There are exceptions. A small dog might be carried so that it could be near its handler's mouth if it's a diabetic alert dog, okay? But remember, when you go to a restaurant and you have your service dog with you, who's the customer? It's not the dog.
Right.
You know? Service dogs shouldn't be in carts at the grocery store. You can carry a dog small enough to be in the cart if it's a diabetic alert dog. Otherwise, its feet need to be on the floor. Where do dogs walk? On the ground. What's on the ground? Dirt. Poop. God only knows. Well, mm-hmm. why are you going to pick that up and put it in a cart where people put their food?
Yeah, that's
how
that's
much kind of more out. Rude and entitled and self-important could you be? Mm-hmm. You know? And you know what? Businesses have the right to ask, excuse me, I need you to remove your dog from the cart. That is perfectly within the law. The law says in most instances, the dog should not be in the cart. There are exceptions. Say, perfect example, an autism alert dog trained to assist a child with autism. The child's having a meltdown. The dog's trying to alert to the meltdown, and the dog's trying to apply deep pressure therapy. The best way to keep the child and the dog contained safely while you're trying to get them out of the grocery store is to put the child in the cart, put the dog in the cart so the dog can calm the child. That's a perfect example. I don't know anybody, unless they're a complete heartless bastard, who would say, no, you can't do that.
Right.
It's obvious the dog is calming the child, and I don't know if you've had any experience. I had two autistic stepsons, and I can tell you a full-blown autism meltdown it's terrific. I mean, it not as in fantastic, but as in terrible. It is a terrifying thing to witness, and it's scary for the children too. So, you know, there's exceptions. The law says there are exceptions, but really, the whole thing that I love the most about the ADA is that, yes, it protects my rights, but it also explains that I have responsibility if I'm going to exercise that right. Mm-hmm. that responsibility being that my dog be trained, that my dog be under control, that my dog be housebroken. And if my dog is not doing any of those things, and groomed, by the way, clean, dog has to be clean. My dog's not doing any of those things, or just not doing one of those things, it's my responsibility to either regain control or get him out of there. And so it comes back to, you know, entitlement versus responsibility. Are you going to be an entitled jerk and, you know, insist to see the manager and threaten to sue? Or are you going to pony up because you learned as you were training your dog that you're responsible for its behavior and the dog's having a problem, and you're going to stand up, be responsible, and either correct the dog or remove the dog, try again the next day. You know, I've had days with Skeeter where he just wasn't doing it. He wasn't feeling it. Whatever was going on, if he wasn't, you know, maybe he wasn't feeling very well, whatever, you know, maybe the moon was full. I mean, just like people, they're dogs, you know, they're living beings. And some days they just are not there. They can't do it. And I, you know what? I've gone into the store. I've seen that he wasn't going to settle down and focus. And I've turned around and I've left and I've come back the next day. Mm-hmm. Because I make the choice to be responsible and not be a bad example. Well, the last dog that came in here did this and this and this and this, you know? And that's it, you know? And that's, man, I hate hearing that when I come in and somebody questions, is that a service dog? Yeah. Well, the last dog that came in here, is this that dog? Is this dog doing whatever that dog did? No. See you later. Yeah. Talk to you later. come get me when I'm breaking the law.
Yeah, this is great information. Great for the veterans who might be on the fence about whether or not they want to get a service dog. If they think that might be something that would help them with their condition. Great information for the businesses and the general public too, who are just generally uneducated about the subject. Really great information. Where can people go to find out more information about what you're doing and everything?
A couple of places. I do not have a website right now. My web provider was horrible. And it was easier to just shut down the page and start shopping for a better web provider than deal with that nonsense. So primarily, my largest reach is on Facebook at PTS Dog. PTSDOG. I also have a PTS dog group on MeWe, MeWe.com/PTSDog, I think. Have a YouTube channel. Just search PTS Dog on YouTube, where I do Facebook Lives, and I'll upload them to the YouTube channel afterwards. And then there's the Service Dog Show. The Service Dog Show is actually changing its name. Used to be the Service Dog Show with PTS Dog. It is now, I think, just going to be the Service Dog Show because I hired a co-host. The Service Dog Show airs Sundays at 8 p.m. on DV Radio, WDVR. You can find that a couple of ways. You can go to dvradio.net, or you can tune into the DV Radio station on Live 365. And DV Radio also does podcasts of all the shows. So you can find the Service Dog Show on the DV Radio channel on Podbean, Stitcher, iTunes, Google Play, pretty much anywhere. Podbean's really cool because they disseminate podcasts to 1,000 platforms. If it's a podcast platform, you can probably find DV Radio there. It's a great distribution system. So, what else? I do have an Instagram. It's PTSDog_Skeeter. I rarely ever use it. I hate it. I have a Twitter also, PTSDog. Again, rarely ever use it. I hate it. and then that's about it. Primarily okay. Facebook right now, unfortunately. The platform is dying, but it's still got the most reach.
It does, for at least for the time being. So, well, that's great. I'll link to all of those locations in the show notes for the show, and I'll link to your book as well, so that people know where to find it, and how to get in touch with you if they want to get more involved or have questions about service dogs in general. So thank you very much for coming on and sharing what your knowledge and your background on the the situation with service dogs. Yeah.
Thank you. It's my pleasure. By the way, just to let the audience know, I do have a staff of moderators on the PTS Dog page, and we answer questions. They're all disabled veterans, all service dog handlers. And if you have questions, please don't hesitate to message the page and ask. We're there as close to 24/7 as we can be to answer those questions.
That's amazing that you have that kind of access and availability to have people moderating that and answering the questions round the clock. That's great. Yeah. All right. Well, thank you again. And for anyone who's listening, all those links that we talked about will be in the show notes. So feel free to check it out at driveonpodcast.com, and you'll be able to check out all the notes there and where to find the book, PTS Dog, Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder, and the Service Dog. Thank you again.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Drive On Podcast. If you want to check out more episodes or learn more about the show, you can visit our website, driveonpodcast.com. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Drive On Podcast.